Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Rut. We got an email last week from our podcast analytics provider, who said we rank number 3 in Qatar for mental health podcasts, and we also rank number 9 in the overall health and fitness category in Qatar as well. So, starting off this episode with a big shout out to all of our Middle Eastern friends. How are we all? I'm recording this on Tuesday. Yesterday was Blue Monday, so this is going out on Wednesday. But Monday the 17th of January was Blue Monday, or the so-called most depressing day of the year. Blue Monday is actually quite interesting. If you research Blue Monday, there isn't any data that I've seen in my research which suggests that Monday the 17th of January is the most depressing day of the year. But what does come up is it's actually a PR stunt created by Sky Travel to get people booking their summer holidays. Smart. It's now wrongly used, in my opinion, as a marketing tool for companies to sell to perceived depressed buyers, but rightly used to highlight the need to check in with our mates, our family, and the people who are struggling. However, why can't we do this every day? I started last week's episode off with a plea to mobilise people into action, to look out for each other, to look out for ourselves, to take a step back. I want this to keep going. Keep checking in with how you feel, keep checking in with other people, and let's make sure that Blue Monday is a day which is used as a device to check in regularly with friends. It really is important. Massive thanks to our partners Cornerstone and Looseheads, who are continuing to support this podcast, reach new people, new audiences, and really make a huge difference to people's lives, which is just amazing to see. You can get £10 off your Cornerstone box by clicking in the link in the show notes below. If this is your first time listening to this podcast and you don't know who Cornerstone are, let me explain. Cornerstone are your all-in-one men's health box delivered directly to your door. You can choose a variety of handcrafted products from shaving, toothpaste, hair care, and sexual health. They've teamed up with us to provide our listeners with everything they need to feel and smell amazing through these very difficult months in lockdown. So thank you, Cornerstone, for being such a brilliant partner. Now on to this episode, and I made a mistake at the end of the podcast last week when I said I'm welcoming Simon Thomas, the Sky Sports presenter, to talk about his story this week. He is coming on the podcast, so don't worry, but next week. But I have a very different Simon to welcome this week. Simon Bates is my therapist and one of the leading hypnotherapists in the country. I've been working with him for a long time, and he's brought me back from the brink several times now. I really wanted to do this episode with Simon because he's such a talented therapist with an amazing ability to condense complex neurological and cognitive concepts down into very explainable chunks. So if you are struggling right now, I hope you can listen to this episode and have a better understanding of why you might be suffering and how it does get better. This, I think, is one of the most important episodes I've recorded so far in doing this podcast, because I know this is going to help an awful lot of people. So, without further ado, Simon, welcome to The Rut. Please leave all judgment at the door. Simon, welcome to The Rut. How are you?
Thank you, James. I'm very, very well on this beautiful summer day.
I know. For anybody, well, most people won't know, apart from the people who are closest to me, that you are my my therapist.
Private brain care specialist.
Exactly. I ask this to everybody who comes on the podcast. Why did you want to come on? Well, apart from me begging you to come on and share your wisdom.
Yeah, the shameless begging. Well, I have listened to The Rock several episodes, and it really is filling a niche that needs to be filled. And some colleagues and I are also working on similar projects, trying to tap into parts of our society that are really suffering at the moment, that have nowhere to go.
Yeah,
they're hopeless, helpless, and frankly, the places that they would go for normal assistance are either closed to them or providing services that are not what they need and really quite unhelpful. You know, we have a catastrophe in the making, in my opinion, with the amount of antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication being prescribed. I think that has the potential to be absolutely catastrophic for our society. And the more we can put a stop to that, the better. People just end up on these nasty pills for 10 years and at no point are any of their problems addressed. And you get a 3 or 4 weeks of the right therapy and you could have put an end to it straight away. And it's just criminal.
I wholeheartedly agree. Hence why I'm sat here. But also, I've been working... God, how long have I been working for you now? With you now? Intensely, probably 6 months?
Well, I don't think we've done anything intensely. Because we started out, you had an issue over public speaking.
That's true, that was...
Which is a very specific issue. Yeah. And we worked on that, I think, successfully. Because
you
started doing the Toastmasters and things like that, which is real credit to you. But then afterwards, something happened. Something happened, and which is often the case. You know, people don't very gradually go into a mental health lapse. What typically happens is something happens around them, a relative dies, a job is lost, an assault, we have a change in our identity or an attack or some kind of some major change in our life which we're unable to deal with in that moment, a traumatic event. And then all of a sudden, they're pushed past their levels of resilience to a place where all of a sudden their mood just fundamentally collapses. That can be a panic attack. And it can just be a really, really low mood, thinking, oh, God, I feel suicidal. I just don't feel I can cope with what's going on. I don't see a future for myself anymore. And I think when you contacted me again for the second time, which really isn't that long ago, when we started doing sort of, I think we've probably done 4 sessions or something like that since that happened. Is that a couple of months? 3 months?
I think I first came to you at the start of February.
Okay.
Then went to Bali.
Oh, of course,
Did 3 sessions before I went to Bali.
Yeah. It was longer than I thought.
Yeah.
But we haven't done that much. We did a couple, you went away, you did a couple, you went away. And
yeah.
And each time,
more.
Yeah. So there have been setbacks and it's been moved forwards. And it's really good to see you thriving at the moment.
One of the biggest things that we've worked on is the process that I go through with my thoughts, which is attributed to both depression and anxiety, really.
Very much so.
More so with anxiety, as I understand it from you, really.
There's a tendency for some people, they will be in the anxiety axis. Some people will be on the depression axis.
Right.
So it's really two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. Now,
if you go into the doctor, you say, oh, God, doctor, you've got to help me. I'm so depressed. Nothing in my life is going well. Now, my friends ask me out, but I won't go out. There's no point in me going out. I won't enjoy it. You know, everything in my life has been a disaster. Or that they're just talking about the past and how there is nothing of any worth in there. And their minds will be going around and around and around. All that content, all the things they're guilty about, ashamed about, just the losses that they've suffered in their lives. And if that is the content running through their consciousness on a regular basis, it's just going to trigger all the horrible emotional responses from their body. It will become a place full of adrenaline, a place full of cortisol, all the stress hormones. They won't be sleeping well and all that kind of thing. And The other side of the coin is the client that comes in saying, oh my God, you've got to help me. I've got all this stuff coming up. I'm not going to be able to cope. I can't relax at all. There's no way I'm going to get any sleep. Just one thing after another. I mean, they're jittery and they're aggravated and they're easily annoyed. And so they're much more on the anxiety axis. And to me, there's no difference between them. Now, the doctors would medicate them differently, perhaps. But now, one is a high mood, one is a very low mood often. So I don't know how a doctor would medicate that. Are you going to lift their mood or are you going to calm them down? There's no real answer to that. It's the same problem. So you can't medicate for that. Mm. What you can do is get them to be a little bit more present. Not the simplest thing in the world, because if they're constantly, you know, they'll be in a room with me. You've been in my room. Yeah. Four walls, a computer, a couch, some plants and a painting. There's really not much in my room that's dangerous. There's not much in my room that's life-threatening. Yeah, yeah, I'll have people crying and depressed, hopeless, but it isn't the room that they're responding to. They're responding to all the thoughts that are coming into their minds.
Mm.
Yeah, and they're completely unaware that that's what they're responding to. They think they're responding to the reality around them. But the reality around most people is extremely benign. You know, there are usually people that care for them. There are usually food. There is usually food in the cupboards. There's a roof over their head. There's electricity that turns on when you press the button. There are opportunities for employment. There is we've never been richer as a country. And yet they're able to create a counterpoint in their minds of suffering, of anxiety, which their bodies respond to physiologically. And the more you're in that mental space of I'm not good enough, the more you're in that mental space of the world is dangerous, the more you're in that mental space of I'm not going to be able to cope with this, the easier it is to just fall into a vicious cycle of shit, which is essentially the mental health problem that we have in this country, the anxieties and the depressions. One is future-based. One is past-based. Some people, it's just the past. Some people, it's more the future. But it's the same problem. They're thinking and forgetting their thinking.
Mm. I did that several times.
You did it all the time.
All the time.
You haven't stopped yet, but at least you're having better thoughts now.
Yes. Talk me through the theory of thoughts. Because I remember having to, well, we would sit there time and time again, and I think you probably agree with me. I didn't get it at the start.
Sure.
And I struggled with the concept of almost relearning how to think thoughts. Run me through what happens and why.
Well, okay. We are essentially creatures that have a conceptual consciousness. That's what separates us from the animals. But that doesn't really get us very far, understanding that kind of information. When something happens around me, in reality, rather than the made-up stuff that usually causes problems, but if something happens around me, how do I become aware of it? Well, it's something I will see, it's something I will hear, something I will feel. When I'm hearing things, it might be language, but it might be music, it might be the knock of someone at the door. Those are the things that can come into my consciousness, that will rise up to awareness, that I can respond to. There is nothing else. I'm not a bat. I don't have echolocation. I'm not a shark. I don't have that electric field around me sensing prey. We're just left with pictures, sounds, and sensations. That's all. That comes into consciousness. Those are the building blocks. It's the Lego of consciousness. There is nothing else we can be aware of. When those pictures are running around inside our head and we're responding to that and we're forgetting that that's what's happening. I'm sitting in a room, but in my head I'm seeing someone snarling at me because I just haven't answered his question correctly. I'm getting an email from a company saying, sorry, we've decided not to hire you on this occasion. Please don't ever bother us again. No, you were a dreadful interview suspect, interviewee. So, and that runs through your head, and you just go, oh God, they're not going to like me. They're going to hate me. I don't even know why I'll bother, because there's bound to be better candidates there. And you're creating that content in consciousness. You're creating a story in consciousness. It can be based on what happened before, which is quite often how it happens. You know, someone gets mugged at a cash point, and that runs through the head over and over again and makes them very depressed. But then they imagine when they're going to if they want to take out 20 quid next morning, it's the same problem. They're imagining going to the cash point and getting mugged. None of it's happening, yet they're responding to it. And the more they respond to it, the more they will. When they're having that content in consciousness, if it's emotional, you know, they imagine themselves getting mugged. Well, of course that's emotional. No, not of course. Not of course. There is the choice point. Mm. There is the point where you need to slow it down. And just go, am I getting upset about being mugged? Yeah, kind of. Okay. Am I being mugged? No. Am I imagining I'm being mugged? Yes. Am I imagining I'm being mugged and forgetting I'm imagining it? Yes. And then all of a sudden you can slow it down and, okay, look at the images. Hear the words. Give me your wallet. Feel the sensation of whatever it is that's poking you in the back, which might be a knife. Run through those thoughts as you're lying in bed, as you're on your couch in the living room, and notice that they are not a mugger. There is no one else in the room with you. Even though you can see him in consciousness, you can experience his words in consciousness, in your imagination. But there is no one there that's threatening you. You're generating that content in the same way that you might generate a nightmare or a daydream. You're generating that content and forgetting you're doing it. You know, I'm a hypnotist. I'm a cognitive hypnotherapist. People assume that they'll come into my room and I'll cast a spell on them and they'll go to sleep and they'll wake up all better. It's not how it works. Not usually. I'm sure there are some people that do that. What I'm trying to do is to de-hypnotize you from running those thoughts automatically through your mind and getting really upset about how many times you got mugged today. Probably 200. You know, people can cope with the mugging. It's 20 seconds of bad luck. The people that don't cope with the mugging are the people that are mugged 200 times the next day, 500 times the day after, and 500 times every day thereafter. Because every time it comes into consciousness, they just go, ah, I'm being mugged, when they're not. And that triggers the system to make the reticular system keep sending that information back over and over and over again. If they can look at that content and just go, oh yeah, it's me thinking, isn't it? There's no one in the room with me, I'm fine. If they can look at that content calmly, slowly, deliberately, it stops coming back, then they can be more present and they can actually notice, oh, the flowers are looking nice today. God, just look at the way the sun goes through those trees. Oh, this is an amazing cup of coffee. Really, maybe I should call Bert. I haven't spoken to Bert for ages. And then all of a sudden, there is space for life to emerge and for different skills to start to kick in and, you know, just other things, habits, hobbies that actually most people do to derive pleasure.
One of the things that I've been exploring, and we've obviously worked on my success complex quite a lot.
Yeah.
A theme that's come up so many times in when I've been speaking to other men about the podcast, people in general, but also guests that have come on so far, is this feeling of I'm not good enough. And I know Marissa Peer and other therapists in this space have based their life's work on working on the not being good enough or I am enough complex. How do you see that? How do you see that evolving in someone's mind? Because for me, obviously, the feeling of not feeling good enough is, as I now know it, is a conversation I'm having in my mind with myself, and that is essentially where these complex come from. The okay, well, yeah, I'm worthless. I'm not good enough. I don't fit in here, so therefore I'm just an introvert who doesn't belong in this part of my community. These are conversations I'm having with myself in my mind, but you can transcend a conversation. So where does the not good, I'm not good enough complex come from? Obviously, it's unique to everybody. But if we look back at experiences that people have, it doesn't just evolve like that, right?
Sure. There does seem to be something rather human about this particular question. Most, probably all therapists will see that not good enough kind of question coming up for a lot of clients in a lot of different ways. It's that fundamental insecurity that most of us seem to battle with at some point. And invariably when we go digging, we'll find an initial experience for the client, usually when they're 4, 5, 8, something around there, when they either did something or a parent said something or a school teacher said something that really made them question whether they were in fact daddy's little girl or whatever it was. You know, parents usually say, oh, you're so special. And then all of a sudden they realize that they're not. They're rather ordinary like everyone else. It can be a bit of a fall. And whether it's a very trivial experience, just like someone not giving them a chocolate bar, or whether it's something somebody said or some humiliation in the schoolyard, whatever it might be, it does tend to... Maybe it's one of those awakening moments when they all of a sudden they realize that they're judged by others in a rather negative way. And that can be very harmful. It can be a moment that the child starts to worry about whether they compare well to others. That comparison that we do to others is... It's soil that is well fertilized for problems. It's bad plants and weeds can grow in that land very easily. Jordan Peters says, compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not to who someone else is today. And that's brilliant advice. The people that constantly compare themselves to others, there will always be someone in the gym with bigger calves. There will always be someone with bigger delts or something else. So you might have an amazing body. I had a client just like this. I had, he would be utterly miserable. He had an incredible body. He'd be utterly miserable if he saw someone with, you know, a wrist that was bigger or a calf that was, and part of it, I guess, gave him that amazing body, because he was so insecure. He'd look around and he'd have to work super hard to get his body to a level where he compared well in that particular area. But almost no one can be better than everyone else in every area. It's exhausting. It's neurotic. Clearly, it's neurotic. But probably for people who are very competitive, which is obviously part of that comparison thing, I'm better than you, I'm faster than you, I'm more accurate than you, you know. I think probably sportsmen, people who are competitive, probably suffer from it far more than other people. And you know, whether it's an early experience or whether, you know, dad wanted us to be faster or the better sportsman or sign up for that team or make that championship, whatever it was, in order to get love back, or, you know, it's the thing that gives us value in our parents' eyes sometimes, all those things. The comparison is often unhealthy, though. When you compare yourself to others, number one, they're genetically different than you. Number two, they've had different experiences to you. Number three, they might have different priorities to you. You know, they might only care about running. That might be the only thing in their lives. Well, okay, they're probably going to beat you in a race. Does that make you less than? And you might have a life. They might not have a life, you know. So that comparisons can be useful, but they can also be very, very dangerous. You really don't want to get into that territory all the time. Now, rather than asking, you know, who's better than me, ask yourself, am I having fun yet? That's a much better question.
Very interesting. I want to talk about the past, present, and future.
Sure.
Because I think it is fundamental to mental health issues.
Yeah.
It's one of the foundations, really.
Mm-hmm.
From where I'm sitting, like, our mind is where time exists. We live in the here and now, which is the present, and you and I are sitting in this room, yet I could be living in my past or my future, and therefore mm-hmm. I'm either depressed or I'm anxious.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, not necessarily. You might have had an amazing childhood, and you might have an amazing holiday coming up, in which case you're doing really well.
That's true.
Yeah, but they don't come to me for therapy.
No.
Yeah, so the people that are in the past are in the future, are usually creating health stories or wars or disasters or whatever it is, which they, by their own assessment, they're unable to deal with.
The past and the future don't really exist, though. Like, if you think about it, the past happened, but it doesn't exist anymore because we're right now.
But that isn't how people experience it.
No.
But you're right, but it isn't how people experience it. No, I had someone, a client who killed someone on a motorway, and for them, the content of that seconds of his life was just running over and over and over again, relentlessly, like a real bully. And you know, those, you know, and it, that was an extreme case. That was a very much an absolute classical post-traumatic stress disorder client. As soon as he was able to stop running that content over and over again, he was fine. Mm. But because the content is so urgent, so important,
so vivid,
it creates that response to it, prioritizes it over everything else. So you don't notice that there's a nice drink, a nice set of flowers, a nice picture on the wall. All you're doing is reviving that content.
How do you, as a practically speaking, how do you get somebody to move away from those states, which they are?
Well, of course, they think it's normal to run all that content rapidly through their minds.
Mm.
They might even be unaware that they're doing it.
Mm.
You know, because they can move through society. You know, they can get into a car and drive it, and all those kind of things. And so you say, well, if they're seeing all this content, how is that compatible to living a life? You'd think that you couldn't. But often it's running around in the background. It's connecting to everything you say, hear, or do. What I tend to do is I tend to go through a model created by a therapist, Andrew Austin, called the three-pillar model, which really lays out how the person's experience can be in several different places depending on their experience. If you think about all the things, the emotions linked to the past, you've got guilt, shame, regret, remorse, sadness, loss, those kind of things. They're all about the past. And when a person is fundamentally attached to those experiences and just running them around and around and around, then they're going to be depressed. It's going to be, unless those experiences were amazing, but I'm presuming that those experiences from the past were not good, they'll just be generating those very sad emotions, those regretful emotions over and over. If that's your life, if that's been your life, it's just been a boatload of tragedy. When I think about the future, it's just going to be more of the same, isn't it? Because you know, if you've had a completely stress-free past, you'll look into the future and go, oh, I could do that, I could do that, I could do that. But when you've been turned down again and again and dumped over and over in that really horrible way and that humiliating way, and all those job interviews you did which really went very badly, well, then when you look into the future and there's a really amazing job advertised in the paper, you just think, oh, I'd love that job, but there's just no point. Every other time I applied for something like that, I got turned down. So in that way, the past creates a very poor anticipation in the future. You're either constantly running the past information through your consciousness, you're constantly running your assessment of the future through consciousness. So bad experiences create an anticipation of future negative outcomes. And you know, if there are things like exams coming up, or the interview comes up, or you know you have to have that talk with your dad, and that starts, and that's any minute now, the closer that comes, that date of the event comes, the higher the emotion, the stronger the agitation, the more likely a person is to go into anger, panic, irritation, as the event actually manifests in now, in writing this moment, it manifests now. But I've prepared myself so well for it to fail, for it to go poorly, for it to go wrong, that as it arrives, my emotions are so strong, my emotions are so out of control, that anything can flip me into those strong emotions, the anger and the panic. Well, if a difficult scenario arises, like an interview, like a exam, and I'm in the state of being highly aroused, fearful, panicky, that's a terrible state from which to do the exam, to which to do the interview. It's, you know, strong emotions make us stupid. And so the exam that you could normally have done easily, the interview that you could have passed with flying colours, then becomes a catastrophe. Oh, that was a catastrophe. One more thing to add to the list that's gone wrong. And so you've got another thing linked to the past pillar.
Mm.
And then creates more fear about future job interviews, creates less capability to do well in the interview, creates more regrets of the way you handled it, and it just goes around and around, a vicious cycle of misery. And it's only if you interrupt that pattern that you're able to just, you know, you can attack it at any point. You can go after any of those pillars because it's a system. And once you break one of the parts of the system, it just doesn't run as well as it used to.
In one of the sessions we had, actually, I came to you and I said, I'm not enjoying, or I'm not able to enjoy the messages of support, love, praise, etc. from people about this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And people messaging me saying, you're doing a great thing, keep going. Messaging me saying, you've opened my eyes up to something completely different.
Stuff that happened in reality.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But for me...
How did you respond to it?
Well, I was too busy beating myself up because that's the way I've lived my life for the last 10, 15 years in particular, is not feeling this feeling of not being good enough. And therefore, actually, that's totally changed my experience of how I live my life, because whilst people... I've gone ahead and created this podcast, people have been messaging me, coming up to me and saying how great it is, and I've not been able to take that in emotionally.
What do you do instead?
I used to think that they're just saying it, they must be lying.
Okay, so slow that down.
Yeah.
So I say to myself, oh, they're just being polite. They're just being kind. They don't really think that.
Mm.
No, they think I'm rubbish. They think I'm useless. They see me as I really am, as a worthless human being that's never contributed anything of any worth to, you know, just complete nonsense and garbage. But those words come so easily.
Yeah.
If a person's in a depressed mood, and if it's been practiced, it essentially becomes like an MP3 that gets pressed. Whenever someone says a compliment, the MP3 gets pressed.
Yeah.
They don't mean it.
No.
They're just lying. They're just blowing smoke up your ass. Yeah. And so, but no, that is a process that you're doing. You know, it isn't part of reality. It's something you're constructing on the fly. I see someone compliment me. I say, no, they don't mean it. Okay. Well, you've practiced that. You've really got it down. Congratulations. Well done. Here's the prize. Would you like to try something else? Yeah. We did some voice work. You know, how to change that voice in the head. Do you remember what we did?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
That can be a bit of fun.
Well, yeah, because when I first came to you, I had this voice in my head that was so loud, it was overbearing, and it was driving me to be like...
Do you remember what it said? Or was it multiple things?
You're just not good enough.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And whose voice was it?
I don't think I could quite work that one out. It was just... It was my voice, but taking the shape of... somebody else's voice.
Okay.
Well, somebody else was saying it to me, but it was my voice, in essence.
Yeah. Okay. So you were assuming that their genuine thoughts were this and saying it in your voice,
yeah, exactly.
but with their head.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's an hallucination.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good luck with that. None of that happened in the room.
No.
Yeah. None of that happened in reality. But you hallucinate this person saying what they really meant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mind reading in cognitive therapy. You call that mind reading. And you see them saying this more authentic, more truthful statement. But actually, it does sound like my voice, you know, if I think about it.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, and it's received, and it because it's your voice, it probably doesn't get as filtered or as fact-checked as some of the other stuff. It just, you know, goes straight in. And when we don't say, hang on, do they really mean that or did they mean what they said? Mm. We don't really do that, you know, because we've learned not to bother. We've learned that it's much easier just to let that concept in that really aligns with our sense of self. Well, I'm worthless. I'm a pointless human being. I've never contributed anything. So their comments just naturally slide by with no particular resistance. If you had the belief that I do contribute strongly, I am smart, all those kind of things, then it would get a bit of resistance. But there was no supporting structure to stop those comments. There was a supporting structure to encourage those negative comments, in fact. What we did was we made them ridiculous.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. Which is a insanely fast way of coping with some of those negative self-talk. When someone's saying, and sometimes it's the voice of someone else, you're not smart enough to get O levels. You're going to end up, sweeping the streets for the rest of your life. And they've got that comment in their head from something a secondary school teacher said to them, or something like that. And whenever they hear it, they just, you know, their arms cross and their heart sinks. And no, then they're not in that shiny place anymore when that comes in, and it's
taking
easily
on that
triggered.
Narrative.
Yeah, and so what we would do with something like that is we would change it. We would give it a silly voice, a ridiculous voice. We'd see the person saying it in a clown outfit or something like that, and so you do something like, "You're no good. You're not always gonna put. You're gonna end up as a street sweeper," or something like that. No. I learned that from Paul McKenna. He does that all the time, and it's hilarious, and it's extremely effective. And if a person does that 5 times really quickly, seeing that person that said it in the clown outfit, whatever it is, from that point on, they just can't take it seriously. Anything you run through your head 5 times like that really quickly really helps to cement it into a new automatic habit, which is what we're trying to do. There is no person in there saying these nasty things to you. There is no malicious force. It's a habit, and there's no resistance to that habit. By putting in something deliberately which is stronger, funnier, you can't take the other one seriously anymore. And then it's just harder for consciousness to generate that utterly negative content. You've put in something, an opposing force, you've put in a counterspell to the original naturally automated comment that comes in and derails you. So it's, you know, there's a lot of this automatic stuff coming in. You know, beans means Heinz is generated by the unconscious, and there's a lot of that going on which supports us. It's beliefs, it's things we tell ourselves, it's the way we see things, it's biases, and it affects our day-to-day experience of the world. The world isn't as you think it is. The world is how you create it in a lot of ways.
Well, another example, and you asked me about this before we started recording this, was whether I wanted to cover one of the things I also came to you when I was having panic attacks over this, wasn't I?
Yes.
And I came to you having convinced myself that I was gay.
Yes.
And that started with, we'll get into where that led to, but that started with a loss of libido, essentially.
I thought it started with the program, the Gangs of London orgy scene, gay orgy scene.
That was what triggered it.
Okay,
but it was the loss of libido that I've been ruminating in my in my head for
fertile soil for
a couple of weeks, and I was thinking,
which is normal for
God.
Someone going through depression.
Precisely.
I think you lost your gran at that point. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that hadn't really been dealt with.
No.
And no. people that get into trouble, there's usually some kind of trauma going on around them, something that is, you know, that would make most people have to sit down and catch a breath. And those are if there is a devil going around causing mental illnesses, the devil is waiting for those moments to happen. And that's, you know, so sorry.
For people listen to this, they'll be like, what the hell has he just said? And essentially what happened was that I lost my libido, or my libido wasn't as strong as before. And over the weeks, this happened over a period of 10 days, really. I then began to associate the loss of libido in my mind with this feeling that I must be gay because I've lost my libido. I don't really want to have sex. Therefore,
I don't fancy my beautiful, amazing girlfriend anymore. Yeah. So what could possibly be the reason?
And so it was then getting to a stage where I was walking down the road, and because I was aware of it, constantly this feeling of, oh my God, I've promised a life to my girlfriend and we're going to do great things together, and now I've got to probably tell her I'm gay. I was walking down the road having panic attacks, looking at men, being like, oh my God, do I find him attractive? Like, is this what it is? And then that Gangs of London scene where I was literally sitting on the sofa with Abby, and that gay orgy came on the screen, and I had to turn it off, and my heart was pounding. And then I sat down with Abby, and I'd convinced myself that I had to tell her I was gay. And my entire thought process for 10 days, 2 weeks, was centered solely around this issue that I'd created in my mind.
The rest of reality disappeared.
And I came to you, and we went through this process. But why did that happen? I got so stuck in my thoughts.
Yeah. Well, essentially, the stuff that gets put on auto-repeat, the stuff that just keeps coming and won't release you, it's no different than my client who killed someone on the motor. He was just running around in his head without any kind of break. It's the most emotional content.
Yeah.
So if the content comes up, no one will ever love you. You'll be single for the rest of your life. You'll die alone. If that content comes into consciousness, for whatever reason, maybe you see that story on a TV program the night before, but your brain just recirculates it and it just comes into consciousness. And it's you dying alone on the deathbed, covered in piss or whatever it is, you know, alcohol bottles everywhere. And that thought comes into your brain and all of a sudden, oh, I can't cope with that. That would be awful. There's no way I can cope with that. You know, it's the destruction of everything I hold precious. That immediate emotional response to the content of consciousness, not the world, but the content of consciousness, it creates a signal through the reticular system, which is the part of the brain which prioritizes what is sent up to consciousness. At any moment, there might be 100 things going on in a room which you could be paying attention to. You might be noticing the touch of the sofa against your arm, the temperature of your feet, how the sofa supports you from beneath. You might be noticing any of those things, but most likely not. Most likely not. Because it's not important. No, so none of that. So the reticular system is the device in our brains which stops boring stuff coming to consciousness and makes sure that anything important goes straight up into consciousness and is given full viewing privileges. So when you look at the image of this is me dying alone on my deathbed, having achieved nothing, and you go, ah! And there's a strong exclamation of emotions. There's no way I know. This would be a total disaster, a total failure. That in that moment, a whole load of fuel is given to that concept. Free priorities are given to it. No, VIP passes to consciousness, and the idea might go away for a little while, and you think, and you calm down a little bit. But anything in the environment around you might trigger it again. And it comes up again. The reticular system sends it up again because it's got such a high priority. And and it comes up again, and you go, oh my God, that thought again. It must mean something. Oh my God, maybe I really am intending to die alone on a... And then just the more emotional about the idea you are, the more it comes.
Mm.
And, you know, the guy on the road who killed someone, oh my God, I killed someone. That was so emotional for him. That content just kept going around and around and around and around without rest. Now, that compares to a person who goes through a tragedy. At first, it might go around and around in their minds and it might make them utterly miserable. But over a short period of time, they start to habituate to that content. And tomorrow, it's not quite as bad. And then a couple of days later, maybe it's half power. By the end of the week, it's coming up a tenth as much as it was at the beginning of the week. And then a couple of months pass, and looking back, you realize, you know, I haven't even thought about that for a couple of days. That's a person going through the very normal grief process. Starts out intense, and then gradually comes down more towards a lower level, which doesn't bother us on the whole. You know, and we can do that for utter tragedies. Your wife might leave you. You might lose your job. In the moment, it's horrendous. The normal process is for you to habituate to that over the next few days. Yeah, that's a normal and natural process for most people, but it certainly doesn't describe everyone.
Mm.
Because there's a large portion of our population that when that content goes into consciousness, they freak out. Exactly the wrong thing to do, because that's what tells the reticular system to keep sending that content, keep sending it, keep sending it. Nothing more important than this. And so it keeps it fresh. It keeps it powerful, and nothing else will fill consciousness while that content is going on.
It was an extraordinary period of 2 weeks where, so many things that ran through my mind.
It makes no difference that it was ridiculous.
No. I'd convinced myself that this was now like who I was.
You thought the thought must be coming for some reason.
Absolutely, yeah.
You thought the thought must be meaningful. It must be trying to tell you something. That's not how it works.
I was picking it out every single time from the thousands of thoughts you have every single day, and I was picking that one thing out and
prioritizing it.
And then giving it so much airtime that there'd be loads of different pathways that would shoot out of it. Like, okay, well, I've got to tell Abby that that I'm not going to have the life that we've discussed together. I'm going to have to move out. I'm going to have to tell my parents. Okay. And
no grandkids.
No grandkids. No, nothing. No. And it
you killed your children.
It was unbelievable.
Moment.
Extraordinary, really.
Yeah. How much space was there in your consciousness?
There was nothing.
For all of the other really obvious facts that everyone else who knew you would say, but James, you've been dating girls for years, and you're talking about girls all the time, and you are sexually aroused by Abby, and all of these things, and there is just that natural and normal mountain of evidence that had no connection to reality for you, no airtime for you, because the other thought was so shocking.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of my biggest breakthroughs very recently in our last session was what did we start the session off discussing?
Well, we probably went back to issues around self and worth.
It was.
So we went a little bit deeper, I think, with that work.
Was this concept, that this idea that you explored with me about there being no self. Self is a figment of my imagination. It's a construct of my experiences and beliefs that I think is what I take on.
Which, again, is quite an Eastern concept.
Yes.
Well, people come to me for self-esteem. Well, if you don't believe in the self, it gets a little bit difficult to deliver those kind of sessions. Now, you say, well, of course there's a self. Of course there's a self. And most listeners to this podcast will say, oh, now they've really gone off the deep end. I was with them until that point. Now they've gone off the deep end. And, you know, and it is such an obvious thing that, of course, there is a self. It's such an obvious thing. In all of our experiences, we think about this being that's making the noises, this being that's making the sounds, this being that's made so many mistakes. this being that really should be doing better than they are. You know, it's this sense of self, but in consciousness, there is only pictures, words, and sounds.
What do you mean by consciousness?
The eye that sees.
Yeah.
You know, there are metaphysically only two things, matter and consciousness. There is stuff and an awareness of stuff.
The retina of life, essentially.
If you like, yeah. a clumsy way of thinking about it is the cinema inside the mind. Of course, there is no cinema. But it's you know, different levels of consciousness for different living species. Plants are very unaware of their environment. They respond to sunlight. Are they conscious? Not really. Even though they're moving towards the sun, it's a chemical reaction. And then gradually, as certain animals move around, they need a consciousness of their environment to guide them. We have a conceptual consciousness, which is much more sophisticated. And we actually get to question what our consciousness is there for, and these kind of things. And we actually have a sense of self. So, I said it, didn't I? We have a sense of self. You know, monkeys are supposed to have it, and dolphins are supposed to have it. You know, if you put a spot on the forehead of a monkey and you put him in front of a mirror, it's pretty much the only species that will actually reach up and try and touch it. Because it's the only species that recognizes that they are a sovereign individual. That if they see themselves in a mirror, they actually know, oh, that's me. It's very rare. We do that more in more sophisticated ways, mostly using rather negative language. But the self that we create in consciousness can only be a picture, words, sensations. That's all there is in consciousness. There is nothing else that you can put in there.
No.
No. And so, sure, there is a process which makes this constructed figure in consciousness. Let's call that selfing, the process of creating something, that we create a self every second that we consider such issues. Yeah. But there is no permanent thing in reality. There's nothing you can put in the wheelbarrow. There's no nouns there. That you can just lift up and put in that proverbial wheelbarrow. There is every moment, every second of the universe, that's something that we're creating on the fly in consciousness relating to ourself. That is selfing, if you want to use that language. But there's no, if you had a surgeon, we need to remove his self. It's not going to work.
No.
It's not going to work. It doesn't fly if you think about that. And the good thing about that is that you don't need a surgeon. Yeah. If you're constructing this version of the self on the fly, well, if I'm constructing it in a rather negative way, yeah, well, I can construct it better. I can learn to construct it better. It's a process. Well, when I think of myself responding in these situations, I always know I'm going to fail. Well, could you practice thinking of yourself managing those situations well? Could you imagine going on a holiday and imagining it going rather well? Oh, I don't think I could, because all my holidays have really ended up quite bad. Well, what if you practiced thinking about a holiday going really well? Well, it's a bit of an effort at first. It's out of practice. It's unfamiliar. But if you have the equipment that is really, really good at taking you out of now, constructing this hallucination, which you're watching 95% of the time about the past and the future, why don't you take that equipment, which is really well made, better than an IMAX, and start running decent content through it, rather than all the shitty stuff that you've been doing over and over again? Because it must be boring, that old stuff. And that frightening stuff from the future must be really boring. How about once you flatten out some of the pressures on the old content, why don't we start thinking about, well, just imagine, I know, I'm sure it'll never happen, but just imagine, a couple of months from now, all these problems are gone. Just imagine that. What do you think you'd be doing? What would you be thinking about? What beliefs would you have about yourself? How does the world look differently now? What values are you pursuing that you really weren't so aware of before? What kind of a person would you be without these limitations? And we just, maybe we do something a little bit more hypnotic around that. We create a solution set around that.
That actually segues really nicely into some of the common misconceptions about your work, right? When people think of, well, certainly when I've said I work with a hypnotist, hypnotherapist, they're like, oh, what? Does he just dangle a watch in front of you and say, you will be
fine.
You will be fine. Well, what are the common misconceptions about what you do? What do you hear a lot?
Well, most people do expect to take a seat for me to get them to close their eyes, and I'll put them in a deep trance, they'll wake up fixed. And we don't really do any of that. That's a bit of a misconception. I'm sure there are some hypnotists that still work that way. You know, they've bought their script off the internet, and they're just going to tell you how you're going to suddenly turn into a super confident person. And for some people, because of the placebo effect or because they're just conditioned that way, that's what they'll need, and it will be a very, very powerful session for them. But a lot of people aren't as suggestible as that. A lot of people are ordinary human beings, and I find it better to work on the specific issues that they bring, flatten out the past, make that difficult to make it so that it's less has less potential to move you off your day. You know, make the future look brighter and shinier. So after we've done some of the work reducing the problems, then we do want to do some hypnosis work. So there's a certain point I usually get to where I'm going to collect from the client, well, what would a really amazing future look like? And usually at that point, they're starting to pick up a little bit. So you'll see it in their body language. You'll see it in their language. And then we design a really nice future. I write out a script or something like that, which is hypnotic. So there's less resistance, you know, because I say, oh, you might become, you might see your earning potential increase each and every year. And you go, no, I don't think it will. You have to kind of reduce the resistance to those suggestions. And when you're in trance, the resistance to that is a lot less. And so I can make lots of, you know, because you'll run around every day and you'll bump into your friends, into your parents, into your girlfriend. And they'll say, James, you just need to snap out of it. There's nothing wrong. Honestly, this is fine. But you won't hear it. You won't be able to adapt it. When you're in a gentle trance or even a deeper trance, those kind of suggestions get a lot less resistance. And so they can actually, you can benefit from them more easily, which is why I like to do that towards the end of the work that I tend to do with clients. Get rid of the rubbish, put something better in its place, and I'll record it typically and just make them agree to listen to it over and over again until they can't stand it anymore. And usually by that point they're a lot lighter and brighter. And if you just focus on this amazing holiday that's coming up, or on this, you know, I'm reading this amazing book, call it a distraction or whatever you want to call it, but it's a much better place. You know, we live in the thoughts, we live in the emotion of our thoughts.
Yeah,
said Michael Neal.
We live in the conversation of our mind.
Yeah, you know, and you know, people in a really bad place, you know, there are worse things than distractions. You know, doing a jigsaw puzzle, doing some knitting or something like that can really take people out of depression quite quickly, because they can't be running the content that they were running and do the task. It has to be a task of a certain level of complexity. But if you're spending 8 hours a day thinking about what a horrible homosexual you'll make, then it's not a pleasant place to be if you're straight.
No.
Yeah. And all the ways that Abby will be disappointed in your parents, you know, it's just that content running it through consciousness is just not ideal. Yeah. So put something better in that place. Firstly, recognize what you're doing. I'm generating content and believing it. I'm thinking and forgetting I'm thinking. Well, that's important. Yeah. But most people, you can say that, I'm sure a lot of people that are listening to this probably don't have an experience of those, of my sentences, the way you're hearing them, because we do a lot of you know, warming up to that kind, those kind of concepts and experiences. Some of this probably just sounds like junk science or Eastern nonsense, But I will tune it into their own experiences so that they can see how, oh, yeah, I am doing that, aren't I? And then all of a sudden it's a much more personal experience. And then we take them from where they are, flatten that out, put something better in, using the same equipment. The same equipment that makes you miserable can make you very happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, most of our lives are led in rooms which are extremely boring. This room we're in is a very benign room. There's no tigers, no alligators, you know, no blood-sucking leeches as far as I can see. And it's just pretty boring most of the time, you know. The amount of hours that we're going to spend doing anything exciting in our lives is unfortunately rather small. But also we're unlikely to be mugged for most of our lives. We're unlikely to be dumped for most of our lives. And once we realize that, once we can move our attention to some of the brighter, shinier things in life, life gets good. Mm. We either become more present, in which case I can just relax in my room here with you, just have a nice chat, or I can start to create an inspiring, positive future. And if I've got that bright, inspiring future, the unconscious just goes, hell yeah, I'll go that way.
Mm.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was there because you spent all that time looking at gay bars. You know, I'm going to have to spend all my life in gay bars now. Well, not necessarily. might be fun for a little while, but now I'll take you to a couple if you want, but I don't think it's necessary.
I want to move on to some questions that people have sent me.
Yeah.
Put this on Instagram and social media earlier today, and there's a few questions that have been quite interesting, actually. Question number one, how do you approach a situation when people might come to you saying X is wrong with them, but nobody understands me? So, in essence, they're unfixable or untreatable. But actually, you've had multiple clients with very, very similar issues. How would you approach that sort of situation?
Well, it's useful to be in a space with them where they're kind of in agreement with you. You know, if they're going to fight you all the way, then it's a bit tough. So you want to probably break down that belief structure first of all. I had a client recently, he said, oh, I've tried everything, I'm sure you're not going to help me.
Mm.
Now, I've tried CBT, I've tried counselling, I've tried herbal therapy, I've tried massage, I've tried all the... And he just listed 10 items that he'd tried, but none of which would have fixed his problem. It's like, you know, going to a car mechanic when your animal's ill. You've got to have the right tools for the right job. Yeah. So this person that thinks that they're broken, yeah, probably has had a number of experiences of someone saying they can fix them but hasn't been able to do that. Yeah. But that's got no connection whatsoever to whether or not they can be fixed. Yeah. They are, most likely they've been to the doctor and the doctor's given them some diazepam. Or the doctor said, oh, we're gonna put you on the list for therapy.
Yeah.
Which means that in 2 months' time you get a triage. If you're lucky, you might get some CBT off the NHS, or you're probably put in group therapy. Some people get put on computer therapy, so they're stuck in front of a computer interacting with a checklist, saying, "How are your thoughts today? Were they good thoughts? Were they, you know?" That's the level of mental health care now, which is offered, and unfortunately, people with mental health problems have to be more proactive in seeking out help than accepting that as what's going to help them, because it's on the whole, it's often not going to help them. CBT is actually quite good for most people if it's done well.
Yeah.
But a lot of the time, there are better therapies out there, and people would be well served. Just ask a friend. Look, have you ever gone to a therapist? Were they any good? Did they help you with the problem? Did they do it quickly? Find that recommendation is so much more important. Than a doctor assigning you some kid out of school who's just gone through the NHS training, who's ticking boxes, who frankly has no financial incentive to get you better. The doctor is incentivized for certain drug treatments, you know, certain treatments within his surgery he's going to be incentivized for using. Doctors are not experts in mental health. They haven't trained for mental health. They have a medical model of mental health. When mental health is not a medical problem, mental health is a disease of consciousness, not of the body. And they just don't get that, unfortunately. You know, they treat the symptoms, they don't treat the causes of mental health. So doctors are not, in my opinion, I'll probably get criticized for this, doctors are not a good source of information when it comes to rectifying mental health. They have a very poor track record.
Mm. Question two. Do you find a lot of mental health issues comes back to a single issue or experience? Does it often go back to childhood or a particular moment which is a tipping point?
Typically it comes back to a traumatic experience of some kind, and a strongly emotional and negative experience of some kind. I honestly think that you can be traumatized in three ways. One is the great big fuck off disaster in your life. You know, you're on the front line and your best mate is just sitting there with you shooting at the bad guys, gets a bullet through the head, and all of a sudden your life's fallen apart. It's a terrible tragedy. That's number one. Or a terrible car crash or something like that. But also I think that people who go through more sort of day-to-day tragedies, something like on Monday I've been put on a three-day week, it looks like I might lose my job, and then on Friday, Gran, who's been around been in hospital for ages, finally succumbs to her cancer. And you would have managed it had it not been for the three-day week that started on Monday. You would have been able, your resilience would have taken you through that second experience and you would have been fine. But you already had a foot on your head pushing you under the water for the week. And then this second thing happens and it just takes you under. And that thing becomes traumatic. It makes you unresilient, and it can really put people into terrible places. And another way that it can happen is it can be sort of a constant minor aggression over a long time. For instance, something like low-level bullying in schools.
Yeah.
You know, it's never they broke a bone. It's not that they got expelled. It's not that stuff. It's the jostling and the name calling over such a long period.
Yes.
A kid never gets his head above water. That can be traumatizing as well. So, but it's, in my opinion, it's always that kind of a trauma, which can happen. It can happen by degree, or it can happen a couple of things close together, or it can just be that absolute clusterfuck of a disaster. And there will be a context for that. It will be in relationships. It's to do with how I'm, you know, getting the lines wrong in a school play. Oh, I was humiliated. And now you can't speak in front of the board or do a presentation to your colleagues. So it can be contextual like that. But yeah, sometimes it is really, you know, those early years are very emotional years. And we're pretty stupid when we grow up. You know, until we're 20 or something like that. But a lot of bad stuff is learned up until the age of 12 or 14. Those are quite formative years. And we often pick up very bad instructions over that time about who we are, our capacities, whether we're lovable and that sort of stuff. And if we can pull those weeds out and just make them flat, or mixing my metaphors, aren't I? If we can pull those weeds up, the garden gets a lot prettier very quickly. Especially when you're younger and it's something to do with your self-worth, who you are as a human being, it will actually influence multiple areas of your life. You can really start self-sabotaging quite creatively. If you have, there's just something wrong with me. I was never loved. I'm just unlovable. If you've got that going on, it can sabotage great relationships. It can cause all kinds of problems elsewhere.
Question three comes from somebody who's quite close to me, actually, and says, James came to you and he was comfortable with the thought of wanting to end his life.
Mm-hmm.
Suicidal, essentially. How do you approach that personally and deal with that? And how do you feel sending someone back into the world hoping they don't do anything before you might see them next?
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually remember a time when I was, when I, I trained at the Quest Institute. I'm a cognitive hypnotherapist trained at Quest. And when I was being interviewed for the course, do you have any questions, Simon? I said, I have one question. How do I maintain my own mental health as I treat people who are suffering? Because I'd been through depression myself. I could be anxious at times. And so I was worried that if I saw four or five people a day who all have mental health problems, who are all quite challenging, some of whom I might help, some of whom I might not be able to help, am I then going to go to bed thinking about, oh, maybe I shouldn't have said that. Maybe they're a bit dangerous, but maybe I should have called someone and got some additional help on it. If I'm running that through my head, I'm never going to sleep again. And so I asked that question, and Anita, bless you, she said, when you can see the client's problem in terms of structure rather than in terms of story, I might be making this up now, but she said something essentially like this. When you see it as a problem that needs to be unraveled rather than their life story, it becomes a lot easier. And I do see my clients in that way. Whilst I do connect with them emotionally in a lot of ways, if someone comes in who is suicidal, I'm probably going to take a few extra precautions. I'm going to ask them, have you actually taken any steps? And usually it's no. Usually it's no. But if they have, then it's often appropriate to take extra precautions. Making sure that they're registered with doctors, making sure that they have a number they can call if they're in a particularly bad way. Involving the people around them that can support them if there is a particular problem. But on the whole, I don't get so worried when someone answers that they've had suicidal thoughts, because most people do have suicidal thoughts a lot of the time. You'd be surprised how often that's really quite common. It's what is the meaning we assign to that. You know, if they're taking steps, that's different. That's a different level of complexity. But if they're just having suicidal thoughts, it's an indication that there's pressure there that needs to be released. It's also usually an indication that they're creating a reality that's not true. Now, if you're in a death camp being tortured, or you've got an incurable illness, you know, makes complete sense to start thinking about suicide. But in the life that we live, the modern society that we live, you know, and we have teenagers going around being suicidal because of Trump or because of Boris or this guy, it's total nonsense. But they can't see it because of the beliefs that they have and because of the futures they're constructing in their minds that are destroyed by those terrible politicians. It's all nonsense. I've been saying that for 40, 50 years of my life, that this politician is going to destroy them. It's just total nonsense. You can create anything in your mind and believe it's true. Hopefully, if you get some good therapy, you realize how much of your experience you create yourself. Then you can start dismantling it. And you can see that, oh, yeah, I guess I'm just in this four walls and there's some pineapple in the fridge. That would be nice. And I could go out and sit in the park, couldn't I? Now, that's reality. You know, most people, once they've returned their focus to that and they have some peace and quiet, they'll self-level and they'll be fine.
Mm.
You know, the people that come in that are suicidal are almost always wrong about how they see the world.
Yeah.
Or they see it in a very, very biased way. My job is to remove the bias as much as possible, or to make it hard for them to create that bias in the way that they're doing. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. Very interesting. Last question. Can you hypnotize me not to be afraid of spiders?
Well... No, Richard Bandler came out in the 70s with his fast phobia cure, and it was really the first thing that people introduced into therapy that worked very well for most people. It's a very quick procedure.
What is that procedure?
It's called the VK double dissociation tool, or the rewind technique, or the fast phobia cure. You basically get someone to experience the what they imagine about the spiders, the mice, whatever it is.
Snakes.
Gets them to watch that content in a very dissociated way, in an emotionally calm and dissociated way. If you can get them to do that and maybe mess around with some of the attributes of the content, for instance, you might make it black and white, or you might make it color or smaller or cartoon or something like that. If you mess around with it like that and go back and forth a few times, typically you're seeing the mice, I'm seeing the spiders, but I'm calm. And it's that stimulus response.
What if the phobia is so bad?
Yeah.
That they can't relive that experience.
Well, that's why you do it in a dissociative way, a double dissociative way, because they can watch themselves watching that content.
Right. Okay.
So they know they can't look at a spider, but they can watch themselves watching a spider.
Because I think some people would find it difficult to even begin to imagine themselves watching that content.
Yeah. You have to also go to a different level.
Right.
You know, if I asked you, are you scared about spiders? And you can go, oh God, yeah. Are you getting scared now when I talk about the spiders?
No.
Okay. Most people say, yeah, no, I can get really...
Well, personally, no.
But... Oh, okay. But you just have to use the word spider and all of a sudden they're grabbing the handles of the chairs and the hairs on their arms. Well, clearly they're not scared of spiders because there are no spiders. There aren't any in my room.
They're scared of the thought.
Of spiders, which is completely different.
Yeah.
So it's useful to point that out. You know, they don't usually get it. But with a few times around, then all of a sudden, oh, that's what I'm scared of. I'm not actually scared of the spiders. I'm scared of my thinking about the spiders. And I can change that. Yeah. Oh, okay. And then we make it really easy and we practice a little bit until we get the emotions all the way down. And then it's usually done.
And this goes to the fear of flying, the fear of snakes.
Yeah, it's irrelevant. With a plane, you know, it's very standard phobia. And I'll get those people coming in every once in a while. You know, you can't educate them. You can't show them statistics. You can't do anything. You know,
statistically speaking, flying by aeroplane is
you know that they're not scared of flying. They're not scared of flying because when they're getting scared, they're not flying. They're getting scared from the 3 months before they even set on the. No, they'll book the flight 3 months before and they'll just turn themselves into gibbering wrecks. Well, at no point in that 3 months are they flying. It's not scared of flying. They're not flying.
No.
They're not scared of heights. They're standing on the ground looking up and being petrified, but they're not high. They're on the ground. It's not the height. It's not the stairs. It's not the lift. It's not the plane. It's not the mice. It's not the spiders. There aren't any. they're nowhere near those things when they're scared. Can't be that.
No.
No. So that's a reality that they're constructing in their heads that they're responding to in a particular way. It's not real. No, the nice thing about unreal things is they're quite easy to pull apart. Reality is more difficult to treat.
Mm.
Yeah, and if you expect reality to change, no, I'm fine, it's reality that needs to change. Well, that's a tougher client. Because, of course, reality is never going to change. Reality is always going to be as stubborn as it has been.
Mm.
But you can change your response to it. And that's the Stoic philosophy.
Mm. Something that I will go into in another podcast.
I think you might.
For another time.
Yeah. I'm
very interested in Stoic philosophy. Simon, this has been an unbelievable hour and a quarter. I can't thank you enough.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
We've discussed a lot about my personal life and my personal fears, but also deconstructed a lot of the issues, the stigma around therapy and your work, I think, but also... deconstructed a lot of the understanding around depression and anxiety and why people become depressed and why people get anxious and actually how they can move away from that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do need therapy, but a really small amount of it. I think most people would benefit from a little bit of help.
Therapy.
Yeah, but don't forget, no, if they sign you up for 6 months and run away.
No, precisely. Where can people find you if they're listening to this and they're thinking... Fuck. Okay, I'm gonna take the step and see if I can have a chat with Simon. Like, how can people find you?
Sure. Well, my business is Freedom Hypnosis, so you can find me at freedomhypnosis.co.uk.
Fantastic, and I will put that in the show notes at the end. Simon, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's an absolute pleasure.